Bart had broken up with Mazook, and she had pleaded with Bart that at a minimum, even though they're breaking up, that she come and testify favorably at this victim impact statement, because otherwise she might be facing 6 months of jail. And who would know, 24 hours later, his daughter is dead. And on the very day that Bart is to be giving his victim impact statement, he's arraigned for the murder of his child that, you know, Mazook had herself unlawfully restrained the year earlier when Bart was trying to flee the apartment with her in his arms.
For over 25 years, Barton McNeil has been imprisoned for the murder of his 3-year-old daughter, Christina. Christina died inside her father's Bloomington apartment. The apartment was locked with no sign of forced entry at the door. He is currently serving a 100-year sentence. This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Today, we're going to speak with an advocate for Barton McNeil and with Barton McNeil about the case which he has appealed for decades. And we welcome Chris Ross to talk to us right now. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I guess one of the first things I want to ask is, you're Barton's cousin. What was your reaction when you first heard that Barton was being charged for the death of his 3-year-old daughter, Christina?
Well, Bart was a distant relative of mine. His mother was my mother's sister, and she passed on when he was about 6 years old. So his father remarried, and they then relocated, and I really didn't have much touch with Barton or his family for all the time that he was growing up. He's about 5 years older than I am. And so when I then learned that he had been charged with smothering his daughter, and then there was some assertion that he had sexually molested her, we were all felt disgusted by it, as anybody naturally would be. And it was like, wow, okay, so a jury convicted him. They must have had a lot of evidence. And I know that there was this rumor that he had supposedly been insinuating that his ex-girlfriend had snuck in and had smothered her. But all that we knew as his distant family was that the court had spoken that there had to have been a jury proceeding of some kind, and the evidence must have been, you know, showed that he was guilty beyond any reasonable doubt. So that's what we believed for the next, you know, 10, 11, 12 years. And then suddenly he made his way on to WJBC after Mazook had killed Linda Tida and claimed and professed his innocence. And it was then that I learned for the very first time that he did not have a jury trial. He had a bench trial. And as I started to look at the discovery documents, everything supported that he was indeed innocent, and Mazook was the guilty party, particularly looking at the lens of her having subsequently murdered again.
For people that aren't familiar with the case, Barton is convicted of the death of his daughter, Christina. He's sentenced. He's in prison. Years later, Mazook Nolan gets married, and that relationship appears to be not working out because she is contentious with her mother-in-law, correct?
Yeah, contentious with her mother-in-law as well as her husband, who she felt was being unfaithful.
She is convicted of killing her mother-in-law.
Yeah, and of 4 counts of first-degree murder. It was something like the movie Fargo. You'd have to read the court transcripts to really understand how maniacal this woman, Mazook, was and what her capabilities are. She murdered, that's 1 degree. She murdered an elderly defenseless woman, that's a 2nd count of first-degree murder. She premeditatively lured Linda to her death. She lived in Crest Hill, a suburb of Chicago, so lured her to the Cubs parking lot located in Bloomington. So premeditative, she was convicted of that. That's a third degree. And a fourth was trying to dispose of the body. She literally made Linda naked, stripped of her of all of her jewelry and identification, placed her in plastic bags and tried to bury her in a shallow grave, and also went to Midway Airport to dispose of her mother-in-law's car to make it look as though, you know, if this body was ever found and it was naked, like it was some kind of a sexual crime, and the victim's car turns up at Midway Airport as though the assailant, you know, got on a Midway flight out of town or whatever. So this is the diabolical thinking of Mazook that the current McLean County authorities want to basically discount and always pretend as though this information doesn't matter and it doesn't exist. And absolutely, it's really important. It shows the character of Mazook and that she's capable of a murder, and she's not just a murderer of Linda Tida, she's a serial murderer.
As you said earlier, Chris, when Barton McNeil saw the news clipping that Misook Nolan had killed her mother-in-law, Linda Tida, he was able to call local radio station, WJBC, and he called right in. He called from prison when he learned about it and was able to actually get on the air, which is just this remarkable thing that would happen.
Yeah, it really is. And it also speaks to the courts locally and what they're supposed to do by protocol. And there's this rule that the Illinois Supreme Court put in place called Illinois Supreme Court Rule 3.8, Special Duties of a Prosecutor. So when new evidence comes to light, Steve, the first thing that the county prosecutor is supposed to do is to take that new evidence to the convicted person, because otherwise, how would this person learn about new evidence coming to light? And then further to appoint that person legal counsel to advise them as how best to use this new evidence. And at the time, the McLean County State's Attorney's Office was run by William Yoder, who then became Bart's judge in this appeal matter. And so he did not take this information to Bart. He somehow was dismissive that Misook, a lead suspect in the Bart McNeil case from 11 years prior, had murdered again, didn't feel that that constituted evidence. And so never brought this information to Bart. So it wasn't until a friend of his sent him the front page news clipping showing that Misook had confessed to murdering Linda Tida that he even learned about it. And so it was weeks later in the month of October, he then called from a prison phone to WJBC. It got answered. And fortuitously, Bart was able to say, look, if this doesn't prove my innocence, I don't know what does. Do we have to get a signed confession from this woman? And sure enough, 14, 15 years later, it looks like, yeah, that's what we need. We need Misook to literally take her pen to paper and confess. And even then, I think that the local authorities would discount that and say, well, she somehow signed this confession under duress. That's what we're seeing in the story.
So, Chris, to fill people in that haven't followed the case, Barton has long maintained that Misook Nolan, his estranged girlfriend at the time, killed his daughter, broke into their apartment, and smothered her. And he came up with that theory fairly early while the police were still investigating and he had not been charged. Can we talk a little bit about that relationship between Misook Nolan and maybe why Barton thought that? They had a volatile relationship, and I believe he was going to testify that she had battered him, correct?
That's correct. He was going to give a victim impact statement. She'd already been convicted of assaulting, unlawfully restraining and assaulting Bart and his daughter, Christina, who was 2 years old at the time of this assault taking place, which was 1 year prior to the Christina McNeil murder. And so she had been convicted of that assault, and the prosecutors had asked Bart to come and provide a victim impact statement. And Misook was possibly facing jail time at that moment in time because she had also been charged with a felony theft case. And so she had broken probation. And so on the eve of Christina McNeil's death, Misook and Bart had a final, I guess, a breakup fight at Avanti's restaurant locally. And it was widely reported in the police reports because they went to the cashier and the waitress. And sure enough, they were both able to confirm that Bart and Misook were in an argument, and Bart had broken up with Misook, and she had pleaded with Bart that at a minimum, even though they're breaking up, that she come and testify favorably at, you know, this victim impact statement, because otherwise she might be facing 6 months of jail. And who would know, 24 hours later, his daughter is dead. And on the very day that Bart is to be giving his victim impact statement, he's arraigned for the murder of his child that, you know, Misook had herself unlawfully restrained the year earlier when Bart was trying to flee the apartment with her in his arms.
So the state's attorney and the police that investigated, their contention, the evidence they said was basically this was a locked apartment. They said that they did not see any signs of forced entry. Barton later said, look, this window isn't the way it should have been, and the fan that's there was moved. I didn't move it. He said that somebody came in through the window. The police said, you were the only person here when your daughter died. There was some physical evidence that indicated maybe she had been assaulted, and of course she had died from suffocation. It seemed like Barton was pretty intent early on to say, she was murdered, somebody came in through this window, I know who did it. The police not receptive to that theory. Did that lead Barton to make any statements during the time he was being interrogated, combative statements. Seemed like he had a combative relationship with the police when they were questioning him.
Well, firstly, the audience should know that Bart called 911 when he found his daughter lifeless in her bed. He was going to get her ready for daycare. So about 10 responders came, two paramedics, two firemen, two persons from the county coroner's office, two police officers in uniform, and two detectives were literally the last to arrive, and it was raining outside. And so for about the next hour, besides trying to render aid to the lifeless girl so that they eventually needed to take her away in a body bag, unfortunately, the police that were the detectives, they're supposed to basically do what's called a crime scene investigation, particularly when it's a younger type person. It's one thing when it's an elderly person, but when it's a young person, they're expected to be healthy and, you know, there not to be any circumstances that they die. So detectives are dispatched and they're to basically look at the scene to determine whether or not there could have been foul play of some kind. And they showed nothing like that. They took some real cursory early morning photographs. They claimed that they had walked the perimeter and they left. And the girl was taken away. And it wasn't until later that afternoon that Bart came back. He had run an errand. And, you know, he's a grief-stricken father at this point in time. He can't believe she was awake and alive the night before. And now his daughter is dead. When he came in back to his apartment, he noticed that the fan was on the floor. And the fan was normally in the bedroom window. And he said, well, how did that get there? Did the paramedics knock that over? And so that begat then him looking more closely at the window screen. And he saw two pronounced, freshly cut holes on either corner of the bedroom window and the fan on the floor. And he then walked out to the outside, the exterior, and he noticed some scuff marks on the outside. And he also noticed some trampled plants out in front of his house, almost as though there's only two windows and a door. It's a one-bedroom apartment. So that kind of indicated that maybe someone had been stepping on some mint plants out front, looking to see where Bart was located at that evening. So he knew that that window had not been tampered with previously. He had only been in this apartment for 6 weeks. So he then desperately called police back and said, look, this is Bart. You guys were all here this morning, and I don't know how police could have overlooked this, but I'm seeing for the very first time this mangled, damaged screen. You guys got to get back, and you guys got to bring an entire forensic homicide team. And he called back four times, and finally, an hour to 2 hours later, the highest ranking police officer at the time, Sergeant Randall McKinley, shows up at the scene and says, what do you got, Bart? What did my detectives miss this morning? He's like, I got this, I got this, I got this, and I got that, and I got this. Well, do you have any thoughts on who might have killed her? Yeah, my violent ex-girlfriend, the one that I'm supposed to testify against, the one that unlawfully restrained me. And it's because of her and our relationship deteriorating that I find myself in this one-bedroom apartment that I've only been in for 6 weeks. And so, officer, this window is not like this last night, and now it looks like this. And my ex-girlfriend had the means and the motive and the opportunity to kill my daughter.
And this is all before there was a cause of death report. This is all very fresh, and the coroner hadn't said the cause of Christina's death, right?
That's exactly right. And when the autopsy finally did get completed, which was the following morning, Bart was arrested within 24 hours, and the daughter's autopsy report showed bruising around the mouth and a bloody nose. And it was only 2 months later that Mazouk herself is arrested in a felony child assault against her own 8-year-old daughter, Michelle Nallen. And the description of that offense was that, according to her daughter, who told her school principal this, that Mazouk had clamped her nose shut and covered her mouth, preventing her from breathing, and had beaten her also in the thigh area, which is kind of a form of sexual abuse in its own right, according to the internet. And then also had said, if you don't behave, you're going to die just like your quote unquote sister, who was none other than Christina McNeil, because the two girls had grown up together. So the incident involving Mazouk and her own daughter comports perfectly to exactly what the autopsy shows as to how Christina McNeil, her condition, because she had bruising around the mouth and a bloody nose.
That wouldn't be the only person related to Mazouk that would claim that there were connections between Mazouk's behavior and that connection to the crime. But to put it in the point of the initial investigation into Christina's death, where ultimately Barton would be charged and convicted of, there was a report of some forensic evidence indicating sexual assault, correct?
Yes, there was. And in the weeks leading up to the murder, Mazouk had approached Bart's former wife, Tita, had said, "Hey, I want you to know, but don't tell Bart this, but my daughter had seen Bart nude at least on three occasions when we lived together, but don't tell Bart anything about this." Well, later the police then investigated Michelle and they interviewed her, and she absolutely flat out said, "No, Bart never did any such thing like this." And there's no follow-up in the police records that show that Mazouk was then confronted with this information that her daughter basically had gone against what Mazouk had told Tita. And so within 30 days, Michelle finds herself severely beaten by Mazouk, and we believe that they are related to one another. The fact that Mazouk was told that her daughter denied what Mazouk had told Tita McNeil, because Tita McNeil is the one that volunteered this to police, that, "Hey, in the week prior to the murder, Mazouk came up to me and told me unsolicited," and these two women did not get along, "that Bart slept in the nude with my daughter." So if you look in the discovery records, why would not Mazouk herself have volunteered the same exact information to police? If police are investigating Bart, why wouldn't Mazouk have shared that with police, but she instead shared that exclusively with Tita McNeil? It doesn't make any sense other than that Mazouk was in on this.
And police did investigate Mazouk at least a little bit to try to follow up on some of this.
They sure did. And everything that she said, you know, appears in hindsight of looking at through the lens of what she was able to do with Linda Tita was an absolute lie. She was shown to be a pathological liar relating to the Linda Tita murder. So she denied having any knowledge as to how Linda died. And even though she premeditatively had lured her to Bloomington, there's no reason today to ever look at what she told police back in 1998 relating to the Christina McNeil investigation as being truthful.
Later on, there are discrepancies in some of the physical evidence collection, and through the years, probably sparked by Mazouk's conviction of this other violent murder, the Innocence Project gets involved and says, "Let's look at some of the things in Barton's case."
Yeah, that's right. They essentially, to get someone ordered a new trial or to vacate a conviction, you have to come up with new evidence. And the very first new evidence out of the gate is Mazouk is capable of murder. She murdered a child in 2008, and then she murdered Linda Tita through strangulation. Both cases related to one another, or both asphyxiation related. One is suffocation, the other is manual strangulation. And then when the Innocence Project then said there must be more here, they then found even, you know, more evidence on top of evidence. So another person who lived across the hall from Mazouk back in 1998 came forward and said, "I think I have information to share relating to this 1998 murder. I was living across the hall from Mazouk, and she was up and awake at 3 a.m. fully clothed, going back and forth to her storage closet," which is contradicts her statements, Mazouk's statements to police, that she was asleep by midnight. So she had no alibi post midnight. Another piece of evidence that the Innocence Projects were able to get was that Mazouk, in some former fit of anger, had shared with her later husband, Don Wang. It's Don Wang's mother, Linda Tita Wang, that Mazouk murdered later, that she had confessed to killing Christina. And so Don Wang, during his mother's memorial service, had shared this information with Mazouk's daughter, Michelle, as well as Mazouk's former husband's, you know, then present wife, Don Shannon. So two women then heard separately from Don Wang that Mazouk had previously confessed to murdering Christina. And so that was then turned into the form of affidavits. And again, this is the same kind of information that's been dismissive by the courts. The last thing, which is the most important thing, is DNA testing. So the Innocence Project was able to request and be granted by the courts to submit the bedding of Christina McNeil to science that heretofore did not exist in 1998, called touch DNA. And sure enough, the DNA testing showed that Mazouk's DNA, her touch DNA, meaning skin cells, was present in 6 out of 8 quadrants of that bedding. So that's usually the gold standard in America, you know, that DNA evidence never lies. And so all of this evidence was presented to William Yoder, who, as I mentioned earlier in this interview, was the existing state's attorney in the year 2011. Fast forward to 2021, and now the Innocence Projects have gotten all their evidence and have filed with the court. And Bill Yoder, William Yoder, is now a judge on the 11th Circuit Court. And he's the guy that didn't think that Linda being murdered really counted as evidence. And so he was then, again, dismissive of all this body of evidence, including Mazouk's DNA on the sheets. And the standard is that any single jurist, if they might have made a different decision during the trial, and of course, Bart had a bench trial, so there was just a single fact finder, not a jury of 12. He should have gone with a jury of 12, but this was, again, his first rodeo, and this is based on recommendations by his own court-appointed public defender. Bill Yoder should not have been the guy to be the judge on this subsequent appeal. And so what we find then is from 2021 to just last year, him consistently making rulings against Bart in that none of this evidence gets to the level that he thinks a single jurist would change their mind and render a not guilty verdict in the Barton McNeil if he were to be retried, which is just preposterous.
And throughout all this, Barton and the Innocence Project have sought to find appeal, you know, taking it to a higher court. The higher court, Illinois Supreme Court, has said, we're not taking this case. Does that mean that that's the end of it, or can the Illinois Supreme Court change their mind? What's next for an attempt to appeal or to re-examine any of this evidence in the case?
Yeah, well, right now, you know, what we're seeing is that the fourth appellate court essentially rose with the lower courts, and that's just the way that they are. In fact, one of the justices there, Robert Steigman, had gone so far as to go on the record to say that, you know, quote unquote, his sympathies lie with the lower courts. And so they're able to basically, you know, hide behind legal rulings where they say, well, you know, we've looked at this and we don't think that the lower court manifestly erred. So they're not saying, you know, that there was an error of any kind. And they're basically able to say, we're just going to look the other way. And we think that Judge Yoder, you know, made the right call. Even though you, Innocence Project team, believes that Judge Yoder should have weighed all of the evidence in the totality, we're going to allow that Yoder was able to just selectively look at each individual piece of item. And the way that it went down was that Yoder would look at, say, for example, Mazouk having killed Linda Tida and say, that's just an interesting fact. What's the next piece of evidence that you got? Oh, well, Mazouk confessed to the murder. Nah, that doesn't count. What's the next piece of evidence you got? Oh, her DNA is found in the bedding. Oh, I think that they might have slept in that bed previously. So what's the next piece of evidence? And so he singularly attacked every single new piece of evidence. And then it was then subsequently appealed to the Fourth Appellate Court, to three justices that were there that have been on the bench for many, many decades and have ruled against Bart on many previous occasions. In fact, three prior occasions. So this was the fourth at bat amongst the same appellate judges that have been ruling consistently against Bart back in beginning in the year 2001 with his direct appeal. And so what we find then with the Illinois Supreme Court not wanting to review the case is that they're busy. They only handle about 4 out of 100 cases that are tendered to them. So they didn't feel that any of the legal issues rose to the level that they needed to review this case. So therefore, they let the Fourth Appellate Court's ruling, where Judge Yoder didn't manifestly err, stand. So it's real unfortunate. So to answer your question, firstly, you know, is there new evidence? Sure, there's lots of evidence to be created in this case. We also think that it's incumbent that others that are fair and just intervene. And it could be legislators, it could be others that hold different legal offices, it could be judges or others that are just appalled at this ongoing travesty of justice in the state of Illinois. And for Team Bart and Bart McNeil supporters, of which there are many, many of us, we're not going to let this go away. We're going to continue to try and ensure that this story get told far and wide, because there's so many valuable lessons to be learned about what is the problem with the criminal justice system in America as it stands today. This is a shining example.
Chris, thanks for joining us, and thanks for arranging for Barton McNeil himself to join us.
Thank you for having us again, Steve.
Thanks, Chris. So, Barton, first of all, tell us the circumstances of this call today. Where are you speaking to us from and a bit about the access you have?
I am speaking to you from a medium security prison in Illinois at Hillsboro. It's called Grand Correctional Center. I'm presently in my cell. We are now afforded these little tiny tablet devices on which we can make phone calls. And this has sort of allowed me to share my story with many different people. And so that's where I'm at right now.
Speaking of sharing your story with a number of people, earlier we talked a little bit about the circumstances of your incarceration. When did you first learn that there was an effort to advocate for the appeal of your case?
In late 2011, soon after Ms. O'Nallen predictably killed her mother-in-law. And from there, you know, the story was pretty obvious from that point onwards that, hey, Barton had been right all along. It was his psychotic estranged girlfriend who was behind his daughter's murder after all. And that launched, you know, widespread public interest in my case, and of course led to the Innocence Project and the Exoneration Project taking up the cause.
Was it just her trial and her conviction that led the Innocence Project to be more interested in this? Were there certain elements of your case, were things that they found that were irregularities that drew this group of advocates and attorneys specifically? And did they reach out to you then with this?
Yes, they did reach out to me, and mainly through my cousin, Chris. But once they took a look at it, and you know, it didn't really necessarily take a later murder for folks to kind of look into the case and say, "Hey, there's really nothing here to support the conviction of Christina's father." Yet there's all of these facts and circumstances and evidence surrounding the killing of Christina McNeil that in support of Barton's own certainty that she died at the hands of his estranged girlfriend, who was Christina's late night intruder. So it's very hard to get the attention of anybody, once you're convicted, the attention of reporters and attention of, innocence advocates and stuff, which are overwhelmed with, appeals from other wrongful convictees. But, and that's what it took, Linda Tida paid the ultimate price for my wrongful conviction and for Masuk Nowlin's orchestrated getaway on the part of the McLean County State's Attorney's Office and their fetish with providing cover for her. I was able to accurately predict in 2002 when I spoke during a court hearing that, hey, Masuk is going to kill again. You can mark my words. And these are in the transcripts and everything. You can go back and read them. And, I could not have so accurately have foreseen a further killing at the hands of Masuk had she not indeed killed my daughter. And I think that is sort of one of many circumstances that these innocence advocates have looked at that said, oh my God, look what happened here. This guy's been in prison all of this time. His life has, been unjustly taken. What word defines the innocent, the taking of an innocent life? And that is murder. So on the significant level, I myself am the victim of murder at the hands of the state who has dedicated themselves, for 27 years to providing cover for my child's transparently obvious killer. And I, those are some harsh words, but at the end of the day, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck, and that is what has happened.
So, Barton, first I want to say that even though I know you've talked about this a lot and many times, people like me, incident of your daughter's death must be an emotional topic. So I want to say if you are uncomfortable going into some of these details, you can stop it. We can stop at any time. We don't have to do that.
No, it's okay. I want people to know what happened, and I want people to know the dark character of those who banned the Clay County criminal legal system. And today's headlines, we hear nothing but cover up. Well, there's a cover up that's been going on in McLean County for the past 27 years as this progression of state's attorneys, rubber stamp the getaway of Nine Child's killer. And yes, it is very emotional, and that she continues to suffer in death as the supplemental immunity and impunity is maintained by the criminal legal system itself, which incidentally has taken my own life and has directly led to the killing of Linda Titus. This is painful to talk about. It's very emotional, and the public should know. And I think it is my duty as the father of a murdered child to continue to advocate for justice on her behalf, even from within a maximum security jail cell, prison cell, which I served my first 20 years in, and even when opposed by the entire weight of the McLean County and the state of Illinois criminal justice system. This thing is being rubber stamped every step of the way by the trial courts, during these appeal processes, and the appellate courts. It's this like hideous old boys network where they collaborate on trying to maintain my known wrongful conviction while the true identity of Christina's killer has been transparently obvious all these years.
So, Martin, into that, I want to go a little bit into that day that your daughter Christina, where it was discovered by you that she had died. And at that point, you called 911. They came. It was determined that she had died. But early on, I would imagine you wouldn't have known the cause of her death.
No, I did not. I assumed it was natural causes. There was no stab wounds or gunshots. I didn't hear anything during the, at night. Christina didn't scream out or anything like that. So I had no reason to initially suspect foul play at all. And aside from which, I was just too distraught to really think clearly at that time. But go ahead.
So when did you become convinced, and what convinced you that your former girlfriend, Ms. Nolan, did this?
Well, a number of things, but as the day wore on, I began to kind of think a little bit more clearly, and it just kind of put these puzzle pieces together. And just the night before, I basically had ended my relationship with the Sook out of concern for Christina's safety, because the Sook had just gone off the deep end with her psychotic obsessions. And for Christina to die just some hours later, I'm just like, that just is too much of a coincidence. And from there, I just, started thinking a little bit more deeply about, the events and facts and circumstances surrounding leading up to Christina's death. And I'm like, hey, something is wrong here. This is just, something's going on here. And I returned to the scene, and lo and behold, plain as day, somebody had broken in to Christina's open ground floor bedroom window that night. And I know this because I know the condition of the window. I walk past it 2-3 times a day within inches of it, and it was untampered with when I put Christina to bed that night. The next morning, Christina's bed, there's an open window, so it's 18 inches from where my child lays dead. The holes were cut into the screen. The screen is like barely resting in place. The fan has been removed from the window. And obviously, you don't need to be Sherlock Holmes. I deduced that, one, Christina had been murdered by a late-night intruder. This obviously was not an unsuccessful burglary attempt. And two, Ms. Cook Nolan was behind her killing. And my certainty from day one, and this is what resulted in my immediate four back-to-back 911 calls requesting the police return to the scene.
So, Barton, when the police came and reinvestigated and there was disputed testimony on the condition of the window, some of the police said they didn't have it in their report that they said there were not as many cuts in the window or holes in the window screen. They said that there were no footprints or anything like that. When you heard that information at the time, did you say, okay, I still don't know what's going on? Or were you just determined that...
No, I said, one, these police are wrong. And two, before too long, I said, no, they're covering this shit up. They know. There's no way that they could have looked at this and looked at my dead child inches away from this open ground floor bedroom window and not said, oh, it looks like an intruder came through here in the middle of the night. There's just no way. I didn't believe that they believed what they were saying. And before too long, I was convinced they were intentionally covering the tracks of my child's killer, which has continued to this day.
At that point, why do you think, I mean, this is speculation, of course, but why do you think that was happening? Why do you think the investigators either wanted to ignore evidence or they didn't take you seriously and they had zeroed in, I think, or what do you think was the motivation there?
I don't know. I didn't say or do anything to justify their belief that I had even raised my voice to my child, much less had, you know, committed any kind of hideous abuse or killed her, for Christ's sake. I think that, you know, this is speculation, and I don't know for sure, but I think they were directed from above to do this. And I don't know. I cannot explain why anybody in a position of authority would knowingly and intentionally, you know, provide cover for a child killer. But at the end of the day, this is exactly what has happened. Everybody knows that Masuk Nalin was responsible for Christina's murder. Now we have incontrovertible DNA evidence that they still won't honor.
So that evidence was that later on, at the time, they didn't have the technology, the resources to test for DNA on Christina's sure. bedding. Later on, they were able to do this, correct?
Yes. And we have, it's called touch DNA. Masuk's touch DNA is all across Christina's bedsheet that she was killed upon. And we have five documentary data points that corroborate each other, that the bedsheet was laundered earlier that same day. Meaning, Masuk Nalin was on the bed that Christina was murdered on the night of the murder itself. That these prosecutors want to dismiss this and say, well, you know, we don't know when this sheet was murdered or was laundered, and all these excuses. Saying, well, this DNA might have transferred. Okay, touch DNA does not transfer like that. Number one, touch DNA does not survive the laundering process. Number two, the state and the prosecutors can cite no date, no prior date of the sheet's recent most laundering to fixate, you know, an approximate time span of when and how Masuk's DNA could have arrived on the bed sheet in some innocent fashion, unrelated to the murder.
I believe that the prosecutors seeking to uphold that said, well, you can't prove that the documentation of the laundering included that bedsheet or something like that, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. They can say whatever they want. We have four documentary sources that all corroborate each other. One, we've got my bank record, bank statement that I wrote, checked to the Econowash Laundry Service on that day. Two, the lab technician herself wrote in her lab notes that the sheet smelled clean. Well, the sheet smelled clean. It was obviously recently laundered, not laundered 2 weeks ago during the prior laundering of the sheet, according to my bank statements. All the way back, 12 days earlier, she wouldn't have still smelled clean. There was no hairs originating from me. I was balding at that time. Had I even slept on the bed one time, the sheet would have been full of hairs originating from me. The reason the sheet didn't have any hairs at all originating from my balding head was because the bed sheet had just been laundered that day. What evidence does the state have to contradict these four or five documentary data points that all corroborate each other?
So, Barton, none. Going back a little bit farther, no, what we're talking about just there was something that you were able to get tested and presented years later for an appeal. But in your initial trial, you wanted to present that theory that Masuk was the person that murdered Christina, and that was something that you were not allowed and your defense attorney was not allowed to introduce. Can you explain what they said the reasoning for that was?
Well, they just said, oh, well, there's no genuine evidence that Mustard had anything to do with Christina's murder, which was flatly untrue. But at the end of the day, they said, oh, well, you can have a fair trial, and you just can't put up a defense. And worse, you can't present evidence in your defense at the expense of the true killer. And so I was guilty by default. The identity of Christina's killer was defaulted to me. Why? Because Christina died while in my custody. It was all a scam. And they knew when they filed the motion to suppress all the SERP-related evidence, it might as well have gone straight to the sentencing, because there was going to be no trial. There was no adversarial process at all. I just sat there in court and shook my head and said, I didn't do it, but if I wasn't able to present any evidence, I shouldn't have even been charged in the first place.
So, Barton, we're running a little short on...
Killer should have been charged.
Barton, we're running a little short on the amount of time they allow for you for this call, so I have one final thing that I want to ask. The Illinois Supreme Court declined to take up your appeal. How are you feeling about your prospects at this point to have your case heard, to have this evidence heard, and what is the next step? What are you thinking about?
It is what it is. It's not really a surprise. It's just over and over again. You know, Christina's killer needs to get all the breaks. Christina's father, innocent, having served 27 years in prison, doesn't seem to get any. So it really doesn't surprise me at all. And if the criminal legal system has its way, I will fulfill my death by prison sentence. And the path to exoneration through the legal process is narrowing. So I'm not very optimistic, I'm sad to say.
Barton, thanks for talking to us today. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The panel Beyond the Verdict is planned for March 19th at Heartland Community College. It covers the case of Barton McNeil and his attempts to appeal his conviction. Joining us to talk about it were Chris Ross, an advocate for Barton McNeil and Barton McNeil's cousin, and Barton McNeil himself, who contacted us from his cell, where he is serving a 100-year sentence. If you're interested in other podcasts about criminal justice or other topics, subscribe to Random Acts of Knowledge on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you heard this one. Thanks for listening.